This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Biden administration's directing federal agencies to ensure better protections for renters. We'll explore the impact it could have on tenants and landlords. But first, the Ticketmaster crash in November last year that kept thousands of people from accessing presale tickets for Taylor Swift's upcoming tour led to a Senate hearing on Tuesday, where Ticketmaster faced bipartisan ire for hours. After Ticketmaster was accused of having a monopoly over the concert industry, politicians and music fans are now calling for immediate changes. And you can call us. Let us know what you think if you've had the Ticketmaster experience before. 1-800-642-1234. If you're a Swiftie who got shut out of seeing T-Swift, what was that like for you? 1-800-642-1234. Perhaps a Bruce Springsteen's fan or any number of other concert tickets that are going on sale this summer, and what it's like to wait in the queue only to find yourself booted again. What was it like for you? And maybe there's a good explanation here. So if you understand where Ticketmaster is coming from, 1-800-642-1234. Two economists joining us today co-wrote an article on the 40 years of Ticketmaster's history at the end of last year for The American Prospect. The title of the article is Ticketmaster's Dark History. Krista Brown is a senior policy analyst at the American Economic Liberties Project. Krista, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Maureen Tasek is a senior fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project. Maureen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start with a little clarification, if we could, and I don't know who's best to tackle this, but an overview of what we've seen in terms of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, Ticketmaster and Live Nation. I have both of these apps on my phone. What's their relation to each other?
Well, you know, these are the same company. They have been for over a decade now. They merged back in 2010. And prior to that, they actually were under an exclusive agreement from the early 90s. So for the past many decades, the two have been working in tandem to consolidate the industry and create the mess that we had with Taylor Swift, and hopefully a mess that the Senate is ready to address.
So with the combining of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, there were calls that now that this company enjoined has cornered the concert going market. And as I understand, this company has been under a consent decree. Is that correct?
They have been operating under a consent decree. This was one of the conditions of their merger in 2010, was that they agree to divest a certain some assets that ended up being sort of irrelevant, and agree to not retaliate, basically to allow competitors to access their venues without retaliating against them if they didn't use their ticketing platform. They have violated this consent decree early and often. It was not a very good document to begin with. It didn't really prevent any of the harms that advocates or opponents of the deal were warning about in 2010. And it violated it anyway. So our take on this on this monopoly is that it was a poor remedy for the anti-competitive effects of the merger to begin with, and that it didn't end up working out anyway, and we would like to see the company broken up. But
well, one of the reasons maybe the biggest reason this came to the attention of the Senate hearing that was held on Tuesday and received some bipartisan support for, opposition to Ticketmaster's control over the concert industry, was what happened to Taylor Swift's fans at the end of last year when they tried to get in for the upcoming Eras tour. They ended up having being shut out, getting in a queue that was thousands of people long, getting to the front of the queue, being kicked out only to have to start over again, and then only to have the general sales canceled entirely. Krista, what happened? What was going on there? Has Ticketmaster explained the problem?
They really haven't. They've used a number of excuses up to this point. You know, initially, I think they just outright blamed Taylor Swift herself for the demand and the fact that she hadn't done a tour in 4 years. So how are they to be prepared for such volume? Despite the fact that Taylor Swift came out right after saying she had been promised that they could handle it. Then they've blamed bots. They've blamed, you know, a number of different things at this point. And I think the lack of clarity in that response definitely reveals some nefarious activity on their part. But ultimately, what I think the whole ordeal highlighted is that there is no choice for the fan for where to get these tickets. And Taylor Swift herself was using a different concert promoter. She's not managed under them. And she ended up having to do all but 5 of her concerts at Live Nation Ticketmaster run venues. And so she could not avoid the ecosystem of their monopoly power.
Krista, go ahead.
This is Motasic. One thing I wanted to add was that there has been an incredible amount of confusion surrounding what exactly happened with the Eras Tour. And like Krista said, Ticketmaster has changed its story quite a few times. Initially, they said they got 3.5 billion hits to their system, that if Taylor Swift was going to satisfy demand for her concert tickets, that she was going to have to play 900 shows. Now she's, you know, she had scheduled only 52. I ran the numbers and it really seemed that actually there were probably about as many seats, 3.6 million seats in her at the shows that she scheduled to accommodate the people who signed up in the verified fan program. What was interesting was that there was a promoter, an independent promoter who's fallen on very hard times in the aftermath of this merger named Jerry Mickelson, runs a promoter in Chicago called JM Productions. He testified at the hearing yesterday. And while this didn't get into his verbal testimony, the written testimony includes a really simple and understandable explanation of what went wrong in the Eras Tour sale, which is that basically Ticketmaster diverted wannabe ticket buyers into this system that was much clunkier than they really needed, than it really needed to be, which was, you know, select a seat system. Now, generally, if you are handling a concert that you know is going to have an extraordinary amount of demand, you can funnel the prospective buyers to get the best available ticket. And that's the kind of most rational thing to do in this under the circumstance. Ticketmaster chose not to do that because they also, not only are they the monopoly ticket seller, they are the monopoly ticket reseller. They're the monopoly, they're the biggest scalper of tickets on the market, right? Is that right, Krista? They have the biggest secondary market.
Growing.
They make a lot more money on tickets that are sold by resellers or scalpers. They take a much larger service fee on those tickets. So that was what made fans so angry, was that even if they had signed up for this verified fan platform and waited in the queue, when they got into the queue, the first tickets that they're seeing are like, you know, $18,000 tickets. And,
what?
And you're like, well, I probably could have, you know, paid that if I'd gone the day of, you know, if I had $18,000, I wouldn't be spending, you know, my life trying to get these tickets. So
that's Maureen Tasek, senior fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project. Also joining us, Krista Brown, senior policy analyst at the American Economic Liberties Project. And you can join us as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you've had the Ticketmaster experience, or if you can see where Ticketmaster is coming from. Krista, we had Dennis, who couldn't stay with us. He called in to ask why Congress is getting involved in this. What's the purview of government in this business?
Well, you know, there are a few ways in which government gets involved with these issues. I would say Congress gets involved normally on a legislative front. So they have proposed various forms of legislation to increase transparency in the ticketing marketplace. But also there, in my mind, this hearing was to bolster support for a proper Department of Justice lawsuit, ultimately to actually, you know, break up this company. And the lawsuit has not been filed. It might not be filed, but there has been, you know, a lot of attention to the fact that they are investigating this company for monopolistic abuses. And we have laws, antitrust laws, that handle this type of illegal behavior. So Congress's attention to it and it being the first hearing this year is really a mark in the right direction.
And do we know what the effect would be if Live Nation and Ticketmaster were forced to split?
Yes. I mean, we can at least have some ideas, because they function very differently in, well, one example is in Europe, where they don't have exclusive contracts with venues over there. And it's regulated differently, but that creates a much healthier system for fair competition. And when I've spoken with European, concert goers, they say that most concerts have multiple platforms ticketing the same venue, same night, and you'll be able to choose the service that you want. So if you break up Ticketmaster from Live Nation, then the two can't work in tandem to basically, monetize and control the entire negotiation system, which was really highlighted in the artist testimony at the hearing, where Lawrence, the band, Clyde Lawrence, the lead singer, he talked about the fact that when you're going to a Live Nation venue, one, 100% of the time it's ticketed by Ticketmaster, and they have all the power in the contract negotiations.
We're talking with Krista Brown and Maureen Tasek from the American Economic Liberties Project about Ticketmaster and the hearing held earlier this week with the U.S. Senate, where we found, in the rarest of times, some bipartisan support for challenging Ticketmaster's business model. But you can understand an $18,000 ticket with demand for to see Taylor Swift in concert, and when you're looking at the supply. Perhaps it's supply and demand, right? But you can also understand the need for competition and how that can benefit a consumer. And where is the competition when it comes to seeing concerts this summer? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation about Ticketmaster and their control over the concert industry, or you can email us ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up the conversation with Krista Brown, senior policy analyst at the American Economic Liberties Project, and Maureen Tasek, a senior fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project. With us today to talk about Ticketmaster's control over the concert business and what choice bands and their fans have when going to see a show. Our guest recently wrote an article for the American Prospect called Ticketmaster's Dark History. And we want to know what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Do you think Ticketmaster's running a monopoly? You think it's fair? You think it's fun trying to get tickets for his summer concerts? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Do you understand the predicament that Ticketmaster faces in terms of supply and demand? I return to our guests here, Maureen Tasek and Krista Brown, and ask you both, what happened to Pearl Jam? Last time, I believe one of the last times that Ticketmaster was facing scrutiny from the Department of Justice, from the government, was in the mid-90s, about the time that Pearl Jam was trying to develop a competitor to Ticketmaster. What happened?
Well, essentially, Pearl Jam wasn't, they were a really successful band. They made a lot of money selling CDs, and they didn't really need to, they were very anti-consumerist, and their feeling was that if they were going to promote their CDs, they were going to do it by giving live shows, doing charity events, doing free shows, and that required them to do a little bit of negotiation. They were really dedicated to the idea that anybody, any kid ought to be able to afford to come and see them play live. And so they started trying to negotiate with their venues and with their concert promoters at the time. And they, you know, had some luck at negotiating a break on a convenience fee here, a break on a service fee here. But they kept hitting a wall at the last minute. You know, they would have the ticketing the ticketing machines in one of their venues all shut down, you know, that somebody would come back and renege. And eventually they hit a wall. And as it turned out, Ticketmaster had told the North American Concert Promoters Association, who were kind of the trade organization of the big rock promoters in America at the time, that there would be no negotiation with Ticketmaster. We're not playing ball. We've got to keep our exclusives. Don't give them a break. They were trying to get the ticket, the convenience fee down to $2, and Ticketmaster, it wasn't like they couldn't do it. It's not like they couldn't afford to do their job with a $2 convenience fee. They just didn't want to set any sort of precedent. They thought Ticketmaster, that Pearl Jam was getting a little bit too big for its britches. So Pearl Jam suddenly finds itself in the position where they're having a really hard time planning their tour. And they, Kurt Cobain killed himself, and they happened to be in town in Washington, D.C. for some, maybe perhaps another fundraiser. They did a lot of fundraisers for the Democrats and Bill Clinton at the time. And they start talking about maybe this is an antitrust case. Maybe we should really start, you know, try to go up against this company. Obviously, a lot of smaller bands, a lot of smaller rock promoters had problems with Ticketmaster in the past. So they hired some lawyers and drafted a complaint that they submitted to the Department of Justice, which was the impetus for the Department of Justice launching a formal antitrust investigation into Ticketmaster. And as part of that, the House Oversight Committee, it was called the Investigations Committee at the time, held a hearing where Pearl Jam came and some rock historians came and some concert promoters came. REM's manager came, Aerosmith's manager came, and they all testified as to how Ticketmaster had sort of established this monopoly and how they had gotten sort of unilateral control over the ticketing market and over the convenience charges that they were allowed to charge. So basically, at this point, what we realized when we started digging into the history is that Ticketmaster's monopoly over and their control over the world of live music really goes back a long way, and there, you know, needs to be. There needs to be a thorough investigation, because that one back in the 90s was sort of abruptly cut short after a sort of Faustian bargain that the Democrats made with the Republicans after they ascended to power in Congress and the Senate.
And that was before Ticketmaster had Live Nation as part of its company and further cornering the market on some of these concerts, venues, and promotions. Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234 about your ticketing experiences. We'll start with John in Stoddard. Good afternoon, John.
Yeah, I want to expand what you're touching on. About 3 years ago, the Green Bay Packers sold out ticketing to Ticketmaster. Before that, they had their own. You remember, that's the third largest stadium, I think, in football. And you just got in the mail. I'm a season holder, also an owner of the Packers. We got these paper tickets. We sent them out. It took about half an hour to disperse your entire season. I've spent as many as 2 hours trying to transfer a single ticket. Ticketmaster is so bogged down. And then a password will slip, and you have to start, and you have to call this number and wait until they can help you. So it goes beyond the concerts. They've gotten into professional sports, too.
I appreciate you bringing up the Packer fans, John. And Krista, how far does Ticketmaster want to grow and expand? What are they looking at next if the Green Bay Packers are now part of their purview?
Yeah, well, it's funny bringing up music because that was actually – or, sorry, sports, because that was actually something – that the Jam Productions testimony really highlighted, that they own 93% of the NFL venues and contracts and or have exclusivity over them, and 87 of the NBA, 80 something of NHL. So they have, you know, almost complete control of that whole sports industry as well.
Matt from Madison emailed us ideas@WPR.org and pointed to a concert in Chicago where everybody had to pick up their tickets at will call. Everybody had to show their name and ID and pick up the tickets that they were purchasing, that they had purchased, so that there was no secondary market for these tickets. Is that a possible solution moving forward?
I think that there are a number of possible solutions to this problem, especially if for, you know, rationally, there would should be intellectually, there should be a number of possible solutions. In fact, Taylor Swift had a really unique program during her 2018 tour, where she actually, because she was so passionately devoted to the notion that her most passionate fans should get first preference, first crack at the tickets, she developed this funny point system where you could do little activities like, you know, write a review of a YouTube video, or, you know, write a Tumblr post about Taylor Swift, or buy a CD and amass more points that would get you a better place in the queue, right? This worked well as far as from my understanding of the Swiftie universe. This worked very well to get the, you know, at least for the most passionate Taylor Swift fans. But this program was abandoned. And I do think that your options when you are dealing with Ticketmaster are relatively limited. Coming to the, in the sports fan universe, I am an Eagles fan. But we live in Washington, D.C., so we're not season ticket holders. But we've heard some reports that a few season ticket holders were not even able to get playoff tickets, and that those tickets were another, it was another case where those playoff tickets were immediately going for $20,000, which is just a kind of obscene. So, you know, the Eagles are not an organization like the Packers where there's a community ownership, I'm sad to say, but it is really a sad statement if it's that hard for, a Packers owner, fan to get tickets.
And we are out of time, but Maureen Tazek, I want to thank you for joining us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Krista Brown, thank you to you as well. Krista Brown, Senior Policy Analyst at the American Economic Liberties Project. Maureen Tazek, a Senior Fellow at the American Economic Liberties Project, joining us today to talk about the Senate hearing on Tuesday for Ticketmaster and the monopoly the organization has on selling concert tickets and promotion. Coming up after the news, we'll learn more about the Biden administration's efforts to step up protections for renters and what kind of impact that could have. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, a parenting writer says American mothers are held to unsustainable standards, and all the moms nod in agreement. We talk to her about her new book, Screaming on the Inside. Now, the Biden administration announced a series of steps yesterday it's taking to try and increase protections for renters. The president is directing federal agencies to examine practices that affect the rental market, including anti-competitive information sharing, how tenants are screened, and how background checks are run. The administration also released its blueprint for a renter's bill of rights, which would not be enforceable as a set of laws, but rather lay out the types of protections the administration would like to ensure. Some housing advocates say the Biden administration's moves don't go far enough and have been too slow, while groups representing landlords, property managers, and housing providers say additional regulations could create undue burdens that would end up hurting renters. So we want to hear what you think. 1-800-642-1234. Do you think the federal government needs to do more to protect renters? Are you a renter yourself or a property owner or property manager? Provide your perspective this afternoon with our story at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mitch is a clinical professor and director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. And Mitch, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
What stood out to you yesterday from the proposals from the Biden administration?
Yeah, it's a very comprehensive, about a 15-page report that covers suggestions for literally everyone. So it's entitled The Renter's Bill of Rights. But what's really important here is that it actually should involve absolutely everyone, whether you're a renter, a homeowner, an advocate for renters, an advocate for property owners, city government, local government, state government. There's something in here for everyone. The big ones that stand out out to me are sort of what they've outlined as principles 1, 3, and 5. There's five principles. It's about more housing, more education and enforcement of existing rights, and then more eviction prevention and diversion and relief. Those are the biggies for me, and I'm happy to dive into any of those. One more addition to my bio, in addition to teaching about rental housing law and practicing it, I also do own rental property. So I see it as an advocate for both renters, but also as somebody who owns and rents out properties.
So you understand both sides of this equation and the push and pull that exists there.
Yes, yes, indeed.
So let's start with more housing. What are some of the reasons we have we don't have enough housing for demand?
Right. Well, so I mean the principle here is to increase access to safe, quality, and accessible and affordable housing. And to get more affordable housing, we simply need more housing. Right. You know, it's simple supply and demand. We don't build nearly enough. And if we had more housing, then property costs or the ability to rent would go down. But we slow down development, and I know that sounds sort of counterintuitive, but by slowing down development and stalling it out in certain places and not building housing and density as much as we could, what we end up doing is making the existing housing stock just smaller and having costs go up. We end up building pushing developers to build in places where they can, where it's easier to build, but that isn't accessible. It's far outside of town. It's not on transportation routes, and that doesn't help anyone either. And so what we end up doing by trying to sort of protect people is slowing down, protecting neighborhoods, and we get into sort of some NIMBYism. That ends up building costs up and housing gets more and more expensive. And so if you really, I know there are a lot of people who believe in affordable housing and increasing density and increasing diversity, but then they think, oh, you know, but I don't want to live right next to it. And that's the thing. Like I said, there's something for everybody here, not just policymakers. You have to, I know the city of Madison is looking at changing its zoning code to allow more density. And in order to do that, you know, it will in fact bring housing more affordable, but it's very hard to sort of vote against or contact your local council person and sort of say, well, you know, I'm willing to have change in my neighborhood. I'm willing to do that. That's one of the difficult things that this outlines and suggests as something to be done. You know, the Biden administration isn't sort of forcing folks to do this, but is laying out principles that in order to increase housing safety, quality, accessibility, and affordability, we need to build more of it.
But as a property owner, the limit on the number of houses would increase your value. So that would be, as an investment, be seen as a good return, right?
I'm sorry.
Well, as a property owner, the limited housing that's available would increase your value as a property investment.
Sure, sure. If we don't build more housing down here, I can charge higher rents. But I'm not interested. I'm not interested in charging higher rents. I'm interested in having a community and living in a community that I love that has people of diverse backgrounds and diverse levels of incomes. And so we need to embrace that, and it means embracing some change and having more housing built in accessible areas. And you know, moving to the next one, you know, we have to have education and enforcement and enhancement of existing rights. Big thing that I like to talk about whenever given the opportunity. Part of it's because I'm an educator, but in order to own rental property in state of Wisconsin, you don't need a license. You need a license to teach people. You need a license, you know, to be a teacher. You need a license to cut hair. You need a license to drive a car. You don't need a license to evict people. It's shocking to me. I litigate cases, and over and over and over again, I'm litigating cases with business people who don't know basic rental housing laws because they don't have to take any tests, they don't have to take any education, and they do things that might seem intuitive, but there are smart regulations designed to help renters and owners, and they don't know about them, and they end up learning the hard way by going to court and being on the other end of a lawsuit. So if we had some minimal education or encouraged education, which is what this does, we have education for both renters and owners, we'd have a lot less disputes in court. And again, that's maybe bad for me, but I would love to see a less litigious a rental housing market where we actually work things out and don't have to end up in court.
Yeah, I was just thinking of education from the renter's side. I wasn't considering what education could do for property owners and the opportunities that would exist for them if they knew what was available.
That's absolutely right.
Mitch is our guest. He is a clinical professor and director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We're taking a look at the Biden administration's proposal out yesterday to help renters with a blueprint for a renter's bill of rights. Want to know what you think, whether you're a property owner, property manager, or you're a renter, especially in a college town like Madison, where we are this afternoon, where people are already re-signing their lease for the 2023-2024 rental season. What's that like for you to have to plan 8 months ahead for folks who are renting month to month with their check? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Then there's eviction prevention. What can the Biden administration do that would improve the scenarios for keeping people in their homes or keeping people in the rented properties, Mitch?
Yeah, so a couple of things that they've so a lot of this is outlining proposals that it suggests local governments or state governments enact, but there's also charging various different federal agencies to take some actions, and one of those is that some federal agencies are going to be charged with increasing the notice period. So a lot of times evictions happen and people get displaced, and then they become a burden, and their costs go up, and it becomes much harder for them to be productive and to provide, you know, just basic services and a roof over their head for their children if they're evicted quickly. And the suggestion in here, and that several federal agencies are enacting, is a 30 for federal housing and housing that receives some federal funding is a 30-day notice before an eviction can be filed. Yeah, that's six times more notice than the state of Wisconsin requires. In Wisconsin, you get a 5-day notice, and then an eviction can be filed. 30 days notice is what is suggested here. It's what some states apply, but every state is different, and so there's this is encouraging much more notice, so that people can plan if they find themselves, you know, because they've lost their job or there's been a terrible sickness in their family or some other change in their family structure such that they're going to have to move out, right? Moving out when you get a 5-day notice and then an eviction is filed against you, that's next to impossible to do that while you're dealing with that, say, family health crisis, that loss of a job, that domestic violence sort of situation. And the other thing in here on eviction prevention and diversion that's really big is that they're it outright says eviction cases filing should be immediately sealed, including so that people who are just have an eviction filed against them don't have that record used against them as they seek future housing. Think if you're abused and suddenly you try to get out or away from an abuser, but you're looking for housing and there's an eviction filing on your record, that is a technically legal reason to be denied housing. Mm-hmm. So everybody can turn you down because they say, oh, I see an eviction has been filed. It looks like you probably didn't pay your rent, when in reality you are the victim of a horrible crime, or you're just simply the victim of a layoff from a job. Nothing that's your fault, but because those records are immediately public, they are misused, and that goes back and loops into the education, is that people, you know, again, it seems intuitive that you wouldn't want to rent to somebody with an eviction on their record, but no one trains owners in a thorough way or licenses them to actually dig deeper and screen people better, and so they resort to just looking on our court record website denying housing to people in situations because those records are immediately available and those records are misunderstood and misused, and technically that's legal.
Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Mitch, the director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We'll start with Doug in Colfax. Doug, good afternoon.
Hi. My question is, I'm a landlord, and I wonder about the laws too. Your guest said that there isn't any training required or licensing. Is there a place like a state of Wisconsin website where I could easily access landlord rental laws? Thank you.
Yeah, great question.
Yeah, so the state, the closest that we come is the state has a big department. It's in charge of agriculture, trade, and consumer protection. So that's a large group of things that that department has to oversee. But we call it DATCAP for short, Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. If you look them up online, you can find their information. They technically regulate rental housing and have issued some regulations and some guidance sheets and some general information. If you're it's available to everyone across the state. So there are a couple of good renter advocacy organizations, really advocacy organizations for rental housing, period, not just renters or owners. Tenant Resource Center is one in the city of Madison. And in Milwaukee, there's Community Advocates. They both have really good information available on their websites as well.
I've always considered them for renters. I didn't even consider them for property owners. Let's go to Sue in Washburn next. Sue, good afternoon.
Hi there. I know in other states, the landlords are held to a certain, keeping their properties at a certain level, a certain standard. Why doesn't Wisconsin require their landlords to keep things fixed, to be able to be reachable if the tenant has an issue? I moved here 20-some years ago. I rented for a long time. I was able to purchase one of the rentals I was living in because I was really tired of moving every couple of years for whatever reason of the landlords. And, it's just something that these younger people cannot find a decent place to live because the rent is outrageous and the properties are just horrible. There's, mold issue, whatever, wiring or whatever, or the landlord's not even reachable. So my kids, I'm letting them stay in my house, even though one's an adult and one is going to be an adult, graduating, and, let them, stay in my house for the next couple of years until they decide what else they want to do.
Sue, I appreciate the perspective. What about holding landlords to a standard of keeping their rentals in good shape? Is that something we do in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and again, it's one of the things suggested here where they're talking about increasing more housing. They're not just saying build it in shambles without any building codes. They're actually saying to increase access for safe and quality housing, and that's really important. I think the caller's point is very well taken. If you don't have quality housing, the housing itself can make you sick and end up leading to you being forced out because you have a leaky roof or mold or any other types of situations. Unfortunately, in Wisconsin, and again, maybe if we looked at some of this guidance and had better communication, but unfortunately in Wisconsin, the ability of local municipalities to, or even counties, to pass laws requiring inspection of rental housing was greatly curtailed in 2015. A law was passed that took away cities and counties' abilities to do what they call routine program inspections to make sure that rental housing stock was safe for renters. So now it's still available to do, and there are hardworking building inspection officials in a lot of cities that do that work, but they can only do it if renters are educated and know to call. They can't do it just to sort of make sure that everybody in the city is safe. You have to call and ask for it.
We're talking with UW Madison Law School Professor Mitch about protections for renters and new proposals from the Biden administration. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Are you glad to see the Biden administration taking these steps? Would you like to see the White House do more or perhaps less? 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation next, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and now we're picking up our conversation with Mitch. He's a law professor at UW-Madison, here today to look at the Biden administration's proposed protections for renters and what it could mean for tenants and property managers alike. And you're welcome to join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you're a landlord or a property manager. What do you think of all this? You can also email ideas@wpr.org. And Mitch, with the proposals from the Biden administration yesterday, what power would the federal government have to implement any of this? How much power does the state have? How much power do local municipalities have? When it all breaks down, who's going to have to take action to make things change?
Yeah, so the federal government has a decent amount of power because they finance so many home loans. And so the loans is where a lot of new restrictions that are proposed, or sort of smart regulations, if you will, that are proposed, sort of thoughtful things, are being proposed, which is the 30-day notice. So for federally financed housing, it's being suggested that there be an actual 30-day notice before evictions are filed. And additionally, a number of agencies, such as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the FTC, Housing and Urban Development, the USDA, which again we think is agriculture, but they actually provide a lot of rural housing under the USDA, are all being asked or tasked to step up and provide more sort of smart regulations to make sure that we have access to safe, quality, accessible, affordable housing, and that people on all sides of this, owners, renters, and people who are neighbors, are really understanding some of the dynamics. The local municipalities still have some powers here in Wisconsin, but a lot were preempted by state law. So a lot of the ability to take action at the state level is in the hands of our state legislature and governor. And then as far as eviction sort of sealing of records and eviction prevention and things, there's a lot of power to a certain degree in the courts. So that's another place where I'm at a lot when I'm not teaching at the law school is going to court. And judges have a lot of ability to right now to seal records of eviction filings. And in some cases they are. And in other cases they are not sealing those records, which, as I mentioned, can sometimes really lead to tragic situations where people are – we just had a case in court this past week where somebody who is living, sort of in church shelters right now from one place to the other with herself and her children. And the court denied a request to seal her housing, her eviction case when, it was right during the height of COVID when there was no vaccines. And so she did not move out. And again, it's really not no fault of anybody here that no one caused the pandemic, but that record is now haunting her and preventing her from finding new housing.
Let's go back to your calls now. 1-800-642-1234, where Angie and Mae Zomani is standing by. Angie, good afternoon.
Hi. I don't know whether it's a question, maybe good advice would be helpful. My daughter's 27. She's a single mom. She's been renting for 3.5 years. She's a Montessori school teacher, assistant. She, never paid her late rent late. She's always been a perfect tenant. Her landlord sent her a saying that she apologized first and then told her.
Yeah, you're cutting out, Angie, but I have the gist here that her daughter has to be out of the house by March 1st, and I'm sorry we're not able to ask any follow-up questions here, Mitch, because of the connection, and I apologize to you, Angie, through no fault of our own, but Mitch, where would you go for help if you were finding yourself looking at having to leave by March 1st through no fault of your own?
Yeah, so for Angie, who is calling from Mazo, if your daughter is also in Dane County, again, the Tenant Resource Center is a great local resource, and they have links up to the legal service or legal aid providers that serve Madison and Dane County pretty regularly. Those include places like Community Justice, Legal Action of Wisconsin, the law school clinics that I work at, are a handful of good resources to potentially reach out and ask some follow-up questions to.
Yeah, Michelle from Green Bay couldn't stay on the line but wanted to know where renters can go if they want an inspection done.
Call your local building inspection office. And then when I say this, I'm cognizant that, you know, in the city of Madison, city of Milwaukee, there's a building inspector, there's a division of neighborhood services or Bureau of Neighborhood Services in Milwaukee. Not every city or county has a building inspector who will inspect rental housing property. Oftentimes it's just building of new housing where they approve plumbing and electrical. But if you don't have one, first call City Hall. Ask, see if they have a building inspector, see if they'll inspect rental housing. And if they don't, you can, in fact, talk to your local city council person, alder person. I have a great anecdote about the village of Lowell, where they once, less than 400 people lived there, but they were contacted by someone who complained about their rental housing, really terrible situation. And the village passed a resolution to hire a building inspector to inspect that one a handful of properties that were really, really shoddy. And so the laws are available for inspectors to respond to complaints. And if there aren't inspectors, city governments can, in fact, pass, ordinances or resolutions to hire folks to do that. So complain to your elected officials if you don't have a building inspector.
And Mitch, we've got about a minute left, but what are you looking for next after the announcement from the Biden administration yesterday?
Well, as an optimist, I'm looking forward to a lot more working and a lot more sort of communication. I think this short 15-page document is pretty dense, and it suggests a lot of things that, again, everyone needs to do. It's not just advocates. It's not just renters. It's not just owners. It's not judges alone or building inspectors alone, but everybody really has to slow down and think about how can we maintain and how can we build better and how can we get to a place where we have safe, accessible, affordable housing for everybody, and we're not kicking people out thoughtlessly. We're working within the market, but we're doing that thoughtfully and humanely. So I think that only happens with better communication.
Hey, Mitch, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
Mitch is a clinical professor and director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. With us today to discuss protections for rental property tenants and new renter protections proposed by the Biden administration yesterday. Coming up tomorrow on the morning show, meet the clinical psychologist surveying hundreds of Black and Hispanic teens about their social media use and find out how it's affected their emotional well-being and academic performance. Perhaps by now you've become accustomed to seeing robots running, jumping, carrying boxes, or imitating humans. But now they're shape-shifting. A new robot designed by a team at Carnegie Mellon University can quickly switch between a liquid and a solid and then back again. No, this is not the T-1000 from Terminator 2. This robot is called a magnetoactive solid-liquid phase transition machine. And it uses magnetic particles not just to shift between liquid and solid, but also to move. The Carnegie Mellon team demonstrated the robot's skills by starting with a little human-shaped enclosed in a cage. That human shape then melted into a liquid and oozed between the bars before reforming into its human shape outside its cage. The shape-shifting robot's already been used to repair circuits by oozing into unreachable areas, and they've used it to remove a foreign object from a fake stomach. Just don't use it to time travel.
I'll be back.
I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.